This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are bringing you a special hour of Radio Boston today. It's from the latest in a series of conversations at WBUR City Space called Phenomenal Women. Phenomenal Women features in-depth discussions with women who have broken through as leaders in fields that are historically dominated by men. From scientists to athletes, journalists to artists, we highlight women who have risen to the top of their fields and ask them about that journey, how they became who they are today, what it took to break through and blaze new trails, and the advice that they would give to other women who are hoping to shatter ceilings. And today, a conversation with two women in biotechnology. It is a really complicated field.
What we do is we apply synthetic biology to bacteria, and the goal is to develop a new sentient class, a new modality of medicine.
That's Dr. Aoife Brennan, phenomenal woman and president and CEO of Synlogic, which is a clinical stage company creating transformative medicines. She and Dr. Pardis Sabeti, who owns her own lab mapping the genome to discover new cures for diseases, are at the top of this complicated field. And as they told me during our conversation, they encountered so many obstacles along the way based on the fact that they were women. For example, Dr. Sabeti pitched a foundation she'd been working with for years on a new idea.
And they ended up basically taking my idea and giving it to two men who had never done anything in that space before.
In our Phenomenal Women series, we start at childhood and early experiences that shaped these now leaders. And we brought you that piece of the conversation with Drs. Brennan and Sabeti here on Radio Boston earlier in the month. Today, we pick up with their professional lives, as you just heard. And I asked them, what would it take for you to just be a person in science that happens to be a woman? Aoife Brennan kicked us off.
I mean, I think if you look at the stats for CEOs of biotech companies, there are about 700 publicly traded biotech companies. I just went through the data and myself for another reason. There are only 61 where there's a female CEO. And so that's less than 10% of biotech companies that have a female CEO. The biotech industry is 50-50. Most biotech companies have 50% of each gender. So we have issues on race and all of other things. You know, we have to build a pipeline. But when you look at like companies on average have 50% of employees are female. So for me, I think to get to a place where it doesn't matter anymore, you know, everyone highlights these phenomenal women like Pardis, right? Who are like superstars, excel all the way through, consistent delivery, amazing. And they're, you know, but they're kind of outliers. You need to have a mediocre woman has the same opportunities as a mediocre man. Then we'll know we've gotten there. Like, stop highlighting these like outlier, you know, the few who make it through this amazingly difficult path. And I think when we've achieved that, when a, you know, B player woman is the same opportunity as a B player man, I think I'll feel certainly that we've gotten there. Because right now, you know, what you're seeing is, you know, men who are only okay are kind of getting promoted and going through the ranks. I think we all have experience of observing that, right, where somebody just fails to deliver and this concept of failing up happens, you know. So you fail at one job, so we're going to give you an even bigger job. And that never happens to women, you know, and you end up with this situation where you've all these like amazing women on a par with like some amazing men. For sure, there are men I hugely admire, but then there are a lot of others, right? And I think for me, it's when we get to that place, I'll finally feel like gender's become irrelevant. But when you look at the statistics and the data, you know, in my industry, we're very far away from being there.
So it's interesting because on the one hand, one wants to say, well, wouldn't it be great if we were in a place where we were true meritocracy? And again, that is a concept that has meant very specific things that have kept a lot of excellence out over the generations. And I want to acknowledge that. But that's different than you can do as well failing forward as a woman as you do failing forward as a man. I wonder if we are beginning now, and Aoife, you just gave us some statistics there. I had brought some with me as well, you know, in labs run by men, 47% of the graduate students are female, 36% of the postdocs are female, but in labs run by women, those numbers go up. You've talked about representation. Where do we get to the point where there is a path for all excellence, where women Pardis who are achieving excellence in a field like biotech, there's enough room at the top that the top achievers go as far as they can go?
I mean, I don't know. I just know we're not there. I you know, recently there's a bruising thing that I won't give the details of, but like where a foundation I was working with for several years to try to get them to fund a program that I had, pitching it to them and convincing them that they should be in the space and working on it. And they ended up basically taking my idea and giving it to two men who had never done anything in that space before. And I had a huge track record in the space, like huge, you know, that was my track record. It was like, that's what I do. It's what I do. It's what I do all day long. It's what I did every day. It's what all my recognition comes from. And I was like, in what world would that ever happen where somebody be like, hey, there's this person that has this expertise. It's their idea. It's actually like their words on the page that we are going to follow, but we are going to give it to you two gentlemen, even though you've never experienced this before. Like literally when I thought about it, I was like the clear skill they had actually never done before. And in my mind, I mean, it's sometimes it's refreshing because I had something else happen recently that was similar, like where it's like on no information, they're just like, yeah, just not you. And that I've been told by a lot of people with like particularly women, women of color, like it's so exhausting to go to VCs over and over again and hear like, you have too much data, you have too little data, you have too much, you know, this, you have too little. And you see people just trying to say the words, just not you, you know, whatever it is, just not you. And I guess, as I said, I've had a couple times in my life, it's been very refreshingly, we want everything about this program, but you. I mean, it's so bad. It's so bad. It's so bad that it's actually like, we're laughably far from where we're supposed to be. And it's so insidious now, right? Where it's like, they can do that. They can be like, oh, there's just something about this. I can't quite put my finger on it that I'm just not convinced by. And it's like, literally, I just can't quite figure it out. And so in those, I think actually sometimes in those rare instances when it's so obvious, when they take your work and give it to two people who've never done it before, where you're like, well, okay, yeah, it's a wrap, you know? And I don't even know if that was your, I think I went off, like it was not exactly what your question was, but I think I was just.
Yeah, but I love the answer. And I'm going to let Aoife pick up on it. And then I want to flex. So I'm going to let Aoife, I want you to pick up on this. And then we're going to go back and we're going to really try to explain in lay terms for our listeners what it is actually you do. So, but Aoife, let me have you pick up on Pardis first there.
Yeah. So, I mean, in some ways it's depressing when something like that happens, but it's somehow kind of validating too, because there's so many instances where it's subtle and you end up thinking, am I being too strident here? You know, it's something subtle happens and you're like, would they have done that if it was a guy up here pitching, or would they have done that? And you never have kind of the evidence when something like this happens, like what you describe, Pardis, in terms of your, it's kind of like, ha, I knew it. I was right.
Yeah.
It kind of validates some of the more subtle, instances that happen in your career, and it kind of makes you feel like, okay, I'm not crazy. I'm not some like crazy bra burner who is, you know, going to, some kind of a nutcase feminist. This is actually a real problem for women. So it can kind of be reassuring.
So let's stay with you, Aoife, for a minute and explain in lay terms, right, what you do.
So I'm CEO of a company called Synlogic. We're based here in Kendall Square, right across the street from Pardis at MIT. We're a spin out of MIT. The two founders are actually two male MIT faculty, Jim Collins and Tim Liu. And what we do is we apply synthetic biology to bacteria. And the goal is to develop a new sentient class, a new modality of medicines, which is an incredibly difficult thing to do. Very few, you know, truly novel modalities actually make it all the way to being treatments for patients. I started out as chief medical officer. I became chief executive officer a couple of years into my tenure. And we had really exciting data last year that shows us that actually we're having an impact on patients with disease. So that was kind of, it took us 5 years to get that evidence that we really could move the needle on an important endpoint for patients. So that was just a hugely gratifying accomplishment of the company that we've been through. So it's been a really fun ride. I've learned a ton about myself and about business and biotech. I'm a scientist, an R&D girl in my heart, but it's been really fun to learn about this new ecosystem around what ideas get funded, how investors think about opportunities, you know, how they perceive risk. All those kinds of things have been really fun to learn.
As I understand it, and you may tell me I'm wrong, what you're talking about with the new modality, as I understand it, is the bacteria actually becoming part of the delivery mechanism for the medicine. Do I understand that correctly?
Correct. Absolutely. Yes. We engineer probiotics. So a lot of people around the world take probiotics as a daily supplement. We engineer them to perform specific functions that are missing or damaged due to disease. So that's, you know, what our platform is. It's amazingly plastic platform. It really is kind of cutting edge. But when you're trying to do something new, you have to pave the way. No one's ever done this before. There's no recipe book or pathway. So we're constantly, you know, working out how to overcome manufacturing challenges, how to find a pathway with regulators, because there is no precedent. So we're often the ones defining the precedent for other companies that are interested in pursuing some similar opportunities coming along behind. So it's been really fun, very challenging. It's definitely engaging. And I think if we succeed, we'll be incredibly rewarding because we can think about diseases in new ways, you know, and hopefully bring treatments to patients who are currently suffering and don't really have good treatment options.
So Pardis, explain now to the extent that you can for a person who's not in your field, what it is you do.
Sure. So I am an MD PhD whose PhD research work is in computational genetics. So I develop tools and technologies to mine the genome of humans and the microorganisms that infect humans to try to understand clues that could impact human health. In our lab, we have a lot of physicists, computer scientists, mathematicians, but also bioengineers. We're basically just like mining and interpreting and also developing tools around our genomes and genomic ways to improve human health. And a big part of my career has been mining the genomes of the viruses that infect humans, pathogens that infect humans. But a lot of the kind of early work we did was during the Ebola outbreak, during Zika, Lassa, mumps, SARS-CoV-2, but sequencing the genomes of these viruses, understanding, you know, helping to improve diagnostics, vaccines, and therapies, and also track the viruses, determine their origins, all of those kinds of things that they call genomic epidemiology, but really using genomic information to help kind of respond to outbreaks. So that's kind of one of the big things I do, but we do also do a lot of stuff that's still continuing to mine the human genome and develop therapies for humans as well.
So in preparing for this, I watched a 2013 video that you did for National Geographic about whether math can beat disease. And it was unsettling to watch this 2013 video where you were talking about Lassa virus at the time, but, you know, tracking how a disease morphs, how a virus morphs, the things that you said sounded like 2019 and 2020. It sounded like you were planning for and preparing for what then hit us. And in watching this, I'm thinking, okay, that was 7 years before. And she knew. So you knew. So how did we not know? You know, how were we so unable to, and maybe I'm wrong, but unable to pick up the lessons of the work that had been done a decade before around tracking how a virus morphs and changes and spreads to this virus that changed the world?
It's funny actually, because people have known. I mean, we've all known since the beginning of time, like that infectious diseases are the major causes of morbidity, mortality, and economic loss of human populations ever. I mean, it's actually like that's the thing. It's obvious. So I wasn't some sort of a savant to know that. I mean, obviously, I just went deep into an area. I think I'm good at identifying, neglected topics, you know, like I think I like always like to go off the beaten track. So it's sort of like when human genetics when a lot of the work in human genetics was not good, I was like all in. And then I developed a bunch of algorithms that kind of made my early career. And then as soon as it got hot, I'm like, okay, this is boring now. And I went to like viruses when nobody would work in that field and nobody published anywhere. And I was like, this seems like it needs some attention. And I might actually leave the field now because I'm like, now that it's not that I'm quite bored. It's also that as a woman, I'll be honest with you. Once it becomes a power game, I don't win in that game. You know, nobody wants me at the table. No one wants me leading. It's pretty clear. I've been told that many times that I don't have a lack of gravitas and people need gravitas to follow suit. And so then I'll be like, you know what? I'll go and identify the next neglected topic. But you know, I'm some sort of a genius to know that pandemics were going to come. It's like, it's obvious. Poor Laura Garrett has been on this, on this for decades before me. And people have been talking about this for a really long time. I think this is the first time the whole world gets it, but they don't even get the whole story. Like, what's frustrating is that they get part of it, but nobody wants it. Like, people are like, okay, COVID, but nobody then wants to like prepare for anything else that might come. We're very, very interesting as a, you know, humanity. We're very interesting and just really wanting to focus like what's right in front of our face and not really being, I don't know, proactive, I would probably say is the word. And I don't think that there is a lot of money to be made in prevention, right? If you never hear about an outbreak, there's no glory in it. There's no money in it. And so creating tools that really prevent something from happening is not really, sadly, of that much interest.
And I'll ask you both that. Pardis, you were just talking about, you know, humanity doesn't only looks at what's right in front of their faces. I think we have seen at least some examples of human cultures over millennia that are very good at thinking long term. But what I hear, I think, is that the money isn't good at thinking long term. And you have both now, and Aoife, I'll turn to you here. You have both sounded the alarm several times in 30 minutes about the myopia of funding and the challenges of funding that are partly maybe afraid of something new, but partly afraid of the woman who's bringing that something new to the table, Aoife.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've just finished a great book called The Good Ancestor, which I think gets to exactly what you're talking about, Pardis. And it was fascinating to read the kind of financial underpinnings of how we make decisions about long-term investments and how the opportunity, you know, how we calculate return on investment today and how you have to discount future gains, which is so myopic, right? So that you could have a huge saving over time. And it's a really amazing book. They highlight some successes, right? Some amazing individuals who've managed to make a great case, like the London sewer system, for instance. You know, it was a huge investment. They overinvested at the time, but it's still operational today. So there's some great examples of times when long-term thinking really did prevail, but it doesn't happen very frequently. And I think gender diversity, you know, equality, equal access, opportunity, planning for the future, making sure that we're making changes now that allow, you know, girls who are born today will have different choices than, you know, will face different challenges than we do. It's kind of similar. You know, you have to create some sense of urgency, some need to make this investment, and it kind of ebbs and flows. You know, it comes in fashion and suddenly everyone's all about, you know, more women on boards and everything else. And then it kind of fades back and we go back to our system. And, you know, this book makes the analogy of like the big stink in London, where, you know, there was all the sewage in the River Thames. And that was until it wafted into the House of Parliament did the, you know, decision makers realize, okay, we need to make some investment. And, you know, there are episodes of the big stink, and maybe COVID was one of those where we realized, wow, we're dependent on childcare. We're actually dependent on these females coming into work every day. I was hopeful that that would kind of be our big stink moment, right, where we could actually fix some fundamental structural things that are very challenging for professional women. You know, it kind of seems to be fading as COVID is becoming less of a daily threat. So I go from being very optimistic to being, you know, pessimistic that there really is that stickiness to implement some of the changes that I think are needed in order to really improve over the long term.
Pardis, let me give you a chance to react to that.
I mean, yeah, I think she's just preach, you know, like, yeah, 100%. I mean, I think I don't want to come into this and also be like so negative, you know, because I'm finding myself just in this, like giving you a lot of hard knock stuff. And like, I have a lot of really great success stories. I have a lot of really amazing men and women that I work with. There's a lot of really great opportunity ahead. So, I mean, I should tell you, like, you know, most of what I would say is very positive. I think it's just also important to be honest about the realities and what we live in. And I mean, yeah, so I think it was because when she was talking, I had like another memory where I got very, I got upset because they were talking about like why the women weren't like doing as much and being as successful and making as much of a statement in COVID. Like, why suddenly all of a sudden, like all of the people that we were all listening to were men for a long time. And given that actually, if you look at infectious disease, when I was in medical school and in research, like women are somehow really drawn to infectious disease. There's a lot of women in infectious disease, but suddenly like crickets, like you didn't hear from any of us. And this person who was trying to write about it and was talking about like all the troubles of like, why it's so terrible that we don't have women. And kind of kept pointing to all the self-censoring reasons we don't have women, like they don't have childcare and They didn't have that kind of support. And I was like, hold your horses. You stop that. Like, I was like, I want to be very clear with you. Like, nobody cares about my family and my family responsibilities. That's not what's holding me back. I'm like, I'm working 7 days a week, you know, 16 hours a day, like every single day. Don't suddenly feel sorry for me and tell me, oh, society and the world is holding me back. You're holding me back. You, by like pushing me out of every single room, dropping me from all funding, telling my colleagues, like my female colleagues, that they need to step out of this one and let the men take charge, literally saying those words, that's what's holding me back. And so, you know, there are all, so I should say, like, there are all these societal things that are struggles, and childcare is a mess, and we need to deal with that. But we also need to, like, make sure we disentangle that from things that are straight up holding women and minorities back. And it's literally just not having resources. It's simple, right? If you give $100 million to a man and $500,000 to, you know, like a woman, we will work our tails off, but we will lose. The David and Goliath is just not real. Like, you will get squashed. Like, stop romanticizing these stories. Like, no, if you don't give resources to people, they don't succeed. That's it. So anyway, I ended up getting negative again. It just happened. But my point is, a lot of great experiences, but also these things should be said.
Doctors Pardis Sabeti and Aoife Brennan both run biotechnology companies here in Boston. Now, next up, a little bit about the people and places that the doctors admire. That is after the break. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today, we're bringing you highlights from the latest conversation in the WBUR CitySpace series, Phenomenal Women. Doctors Pardis Sabeti and Aoife Brennan run biotechnology organizations in a historically male-run field. They have ascended to the top, but not without real obstacles along the way. Before the break, we heard from them about some of the barriers thrown up in the industry based on their gender, a phenomenon that got worse the further they moved in their education and their professional development. It is hard stuff, and so we decided to take a break and have a little fun with a lightning round, starting with their favorite way to recharge their batteries. Dr. Brennan got woodsy.
A walk in the woods with the dog, you know, away from everything, no phone, no nothing, just me and the dog in the woods. And I tell her all kinds of secrets and she never tells anyone. It's all good.
How about you, Pardis?
Exercise of some sort. I mean, so just using my body and kind of just like having that be the main thing going on.
And Pardis, if there were a woman in history you could meet, who would you meet?
I mean, Marie Curie, of course. It's just, I mean, that woman is such a like rock. I would say like everything about her, I'm just like, how, what, you're unbelievable. So, yeah, there's many, but Marie Curie, I just want to know, yeah, how she.
And how about you? How about you, Aoife?
Yeah, the person I always wanted to meet growing up was Madeleine Albright, and she died recently because, you know, as I was kind of, you know, as a high school kind of young professional, I would always look at these pictures and she was the one woman who was unapologetic about her femininity. You know, there's always these pictures of like all the gray suits or all the navy suits. And then there she was in this bright pink with pearls and, you know, this bright pink outfit. And she never, you know, she didn't ever seem to make an attempt to fit in. So many other women that were public figures as I was growing up just kind of were apologetic, they were trying to blend in, were apologetic about being female, but she always had this kind of motherly, unapologetically female, but also, you know, tough as nails, get stuff done persona that I just personally really identified with. And I just had always wanted, I just love to have a coffee with her and to like learn and hear some of the war stories. I think she'd be phenomenal.
Okay, so I'm so glad you brought that up too, because this is a tricky one and I want to dive into it a little bit. Femininity is a complicated concept. And for women in leadership, grappling with expectations of femininity, especially as we increasingly understand gender fluidity, people's ability to choose how they identify, and the need to stop ascribing so heavily, you know, both gender identity and gender norms. How do you think about femininity? Is it a piece of your life? Is it a piece of how you engage in your work? Is there a feminine womanhood that comes to mix? Is that an outdated concept? Is that something that stays somewhere else in your life? I'm really curious how you think about it. Pardis, I'll let you pick up.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm one of those people that like wear sweatpants every single day. But if there's like a gala, I'll like do it up. I get really excited for. So it's sort of like I like to be feminine, but kind of like a vampire. Just like once every while, I'll just be like, okay, I did that. I don't know. I don't see myself as particularly feminine. But I do realize I have a lot of feminine traits, and I enjoy and embrace them. Kind of a deep level of like mama bear to my lab, and a deep level of like empathy with everybody that I interact with. And so, we think about it, right? When women came into the workforce, like how many things changed, how many social drivers changed when we really were at the conversation and we could lead in a lot of ways where we, started driving society in a better direction, in a more kind and caring direction, but also just coming up with ideas that are uniquely female to do so. And so I embrace that part of myself that is feminine, that has ideas that come from being a woman and living, embodying the pieces. Like I said, it's not something that I'm constantly coming with, but I do more and more appreciate, bringing that to bear in my life and in my practice.
Aoife, pick up on that.
I think the most important thing for me is to be authentic for yourself. Because, particularly in small companies, I work in small biotech companies, the team here can sniff out lack of authenticity in a moment. So even if I was to, decide that to succeed, I would need to have a more macho, hard-charging persona or, something else, it's not going to work because, you have to present as your authentic self. I think society owes us all to adapt to us, being able to thrive as our authentic selves. So I think that's just, it's a self-defeating thing to try and alter your persona in order to fit some kind of, idea of what you think a leader should be. Having said that, I sometimes wonder for myself I'm feminine, but not too feminine, and maybe I'm part of the problem and that, I'm the one who made it through because, I'm girly, but not too girly. I do try to bring out and to be very vocal about, the fact that I'm a mom. I have small kids at home. Everyone in the company knows that, I have kids. Everyone I interact with professionally. I remember a talk that it was kind of one of my first, big talks. I worked at Biogen for 5 years before coming here, and I had an opportunity to give a talk about a topic, and I was speaking to one of my female colleagues and mentor, and I said, I'm going to make the theme of this topic. It's kind of like almost like a TED talk. I'm going to make the theme of this topic about how developing a drug is like giving birth to a baby. And she was horrified. She said, oh my God, that is a terrible idea. It's going to damage your career. You have to make a sports analogy, a war analogy, all fine. An analogy to labor and delivery, not okay. It's too out there, too female, too rubbing people's faces, noses in it. And I had to really reflect. I'm like, do I try to, do some kind of like, make it Olympics or make it some kind of more masculine thing? And I'm like, no, I've had 3 kids. I'm, so many people will identify with this analogy. At least 50% of the people in the room will. So I kind of went out on a limb, but it felt like I was taking a big risk, despite the fact that I listened to, all of these sports analogies every day in business, right? Like the home run, slam dunk, you're constantly, if one person, another person quotes Sun Tzu to me, I'll go crazy, right? So it's constantly art of war. Yeah, yeah. We're constantly surrounded by language that's, just has very masculine origins. And, I did it. It felt risky, but, I think it went over okay. And that gave me courage to be, to double down, to be even more kind of unapologetic, I guess, about it and not try to hide it or to pretend that my kids don't exist or something else. So I made that calculus with myself that I wasn't willing to sacrifice who I was in order to succeed professionally. I was just going to give it my all and be myself and see what happened. And that's kind of been my modus operandi, if you will.
Did that talk go well?
Yes, I think it went well. I got some positive feedback. I remember the CEO at the time, George Skangos, walked into the back of the room just as I was starting to give the talk. And I had this like sinking feeling like, oh my God, this could be career suicide, you know, if it doesn't go well. But, you know, I think the analogy worked, hopefully, and it didn't come across too scary to men in the room.
Dr. Aoife Brennan, President and CEO of Synlogic, along with Dr. Pardis Sabeti, who runs her own lab mapping the genome to discover new cures for diseases. That's another excerpt from our conversation at WBUR CitySpace as part of the Phenomenal Women series. When we return from the break, the joy of pursuing your ideas. Stay tuned. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is Radio Boston. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and we are bringing you highlights today from our latest conversation in the Phenomenal Women series at WBUR CitySpace. The focus now, biotech. Dr. Pardis Sabeti runs her own lab, mapping the genome to discover new cures for diseases. And Dr. Aoife Brennan is president and CEO of Synlogic Incorporated. In this highlight, we pick up with the joy the doctors find in their work. While their path in the industry has been hard, Dr. Sabeti tells us that there is freedom to really think, too.
The joy is just having an idea and playing it out and getting to tease it out. I mean, I was just talking to a student today about just like how fun it is to have like a crackpot idea that you just like can't stop thinking about until like you just, you know, tease it out. And every morning you wake up with another thought and your brain is like solving the problem when you're sleeping. I mean, there's just so much joy in that. It's really, it's like just getting to solve a puzzle all day long, you know, in your job. And so for those who like puzzles, it's like the greatest job in the world. Like it really is. And just fun to really get excellent at it. And also the joy is working with really smart people trying to solve those puzzles too. So there's so much joy in a job. It's not for everybody. You got to really enjoy failure too, and to be able to laugh hard when like things go really rock bottom, and to see each kind of thing is just another opportunity to learn. But if you like that, and I'm the kind of person who actually likes that, I don't fear failure, and I like going out on a limb and finding out how, like, if I'm right or I'm wrong and trying to get to just better, you kind of constantly get to learn to get better at solving those puzzles until you can find something. So it's a very, very fun field to be. And I often say it's like being a kid in a candy store. Like every time you turn around, it's like another cool, phenomenal thing. And if I had like 10 lifetimes, I still wouldn't have enough time to do all the stuff I want to do as far as science goes. So from that perspective, it's a really great job.
Where's the joy for you, Aoife?
Yeah, I agree 100% with a lot of the problem solving and the being able to come together as a team to crack a nut, you know, with the problem. And sometimes when people come asking, you know, well, how do I know biotech is for me? How do I know clinical development is for me? I described them saying, okay, if you're getting a data set, you know, you do a study, it takes you two years to enroll a trial, you get the data, it's been analyzed in India, you know that it's due in at 1 a.m. in the morning. If you're the kind of person who wants to set your alarm clock at 1 a.m. and get up and log on and look at that data right as soon as you can, because that's, you know, everything for you, then you know this is the right job. If you're like, oh, I'll wait till tomorrow, whatever, you know, that's probably not, because you have to, it's so hard. And there's so many challenges, so much failure along the way. But those moments, and I've had maybe three or four in my professional career where you've executed this incredibly difficult program with a small group of people who are like, you know, your family. By the end of it, you know, you've usually been working on this for like 3-4 years, every day and night, thinking about what we can do next. And you're in that room with them and you're, you know, opening the data together for the first time. And it's almost like spiritual experience, right? When you've been in that room with this team who know each other so well, and you're catching eye contact as people are flicking through the pages, and the data looks amazing and it's exactly what you thought it would look like. Just that experience, it's almost like being present at the birth of a child or something. You know, it's kind of that level of spirituality, and it's just so amazing. And once you've had that experience with a group, I can remember back on all the trial readouts, and some don't go your way, right? And some you open up and it's like, oh, you know, and you're dealing with as a small team, you have this opportunity to cope, and then you have to go tell the world. But on those occasions when it works, it creates just this bond with that team, right? That, you know, I know for the rest of my career, I can call up any one of them and we get right back to, you know, the kind of relationship we had back in the day, because we have that kind of experience together of just not knowing and the uncertainty of like, oh, it could go our way. It may be great. It may be bad. It may be somewhere in the middle where we, you know, didn't do the right study or we made some assumption that didn't hold true. But that's, you know, the real joy in drug development. And we've had some experience of that. You know, I think that the vaccine data, you know, I can only imagine what the people at Moderna and Pfizer were, you know, that those people who first cracked that data set, you know, that the experience that they had. But that's the real, you know, that's what we live for as drug developers and in biotech.
Before I go to my next question, Pardis, is there anything you want to pick up on from there?
No, just that was a joy to listen to. Yeah. Well, yes.
Yeah. And seeing the two of you light up, right, in talking about that, there is a curiosity and a hunger to poke at things that I see in the two of you, to poke it and prod it and stretch it and know. And if you don't know, try again. And there's both a curiosity and a resilience to that that strike me as they must be fundamental to who you are, Pardis. Is there a special resilience or curiosity? And I already can tell you're not a person who's like, yeah, I'm the best at such and such. Mm-hmm. But is there a kind of curiosity or a resilience in you that you think is part of the drive that's gotten you through the work you've done?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can say that even, but I don't know. I mean, like my life story, but like I'm the Terminator. I should be dead many times over. I mean, yeah. You got it. I mean, so many crazy things have happened to me in my life where, I almost died several times. Like, I think it's one of those things where you're like, you know what? Like, I'm every day is like a very much like an afterlife. And so for me, it's like, I'm just going to keep being curious until I'm finally get like, you know, wiped out. And in the meantime, I'm just going to keep going. So I think certainly from that perspective, I think one of the attributes I feel is like I've got to have is resilience. Because I mean, as one example, I was a passenger in a vehicle accident where I shattered my pelvis and both my knees and had like zero, you know, it was a 10 out of 10 accident. I wasn't supposed to be alive. And I'm half metal now. But you know, and that, I mean, the first few days, I definitely was like, just kill me. Like, somebody kill me. Like, I definitely didn't want to be alive. But then I was just like, I'm going to figure everything out I can about this. And I got really into it. And I became like this, like, super expert on nutrition and, you know, a lot of Eastern medicine and all the different practices, and just spoke to every single person that ever had an accident like mine. And, you know, like, that's just... It was one of these things. I'm going to science the crap out of this. I'm going to figure out exactly what has to happen and get some data points on this. And frankly, like, realize how bad we are at that. We're really bad. We are really good at catastrophic events and then really bad at thriving. So I was supposed to be a handicap, and the disabilities committees were talking to me, and that was like going to be my life, and people are going to be happy if I could bend my knees. And that was it, you know? And I was like, that's not in the cards for me. So for me, every insanity is an opportunity to learn. And certainly you got to like failure, not yourself. You got to be, you shouldn't like failure. You should be comfortable with failure and challenge if you want to survive in this field or in any field, like to just live on this earth today. I mean, we're all embracing so much challenge. But certainly I'm a person who, embraces a lot of challenges and has been through a particularly, I think one of my students once said it of like, it's no fun talking to parties because whatever type of story you have, she's like something that's like, oh yeah, it was kind of like when this happened to me, and people were like, never mind. Certainly that's probably one of the things that's most defining about me that I can agree with, is that whatever the insanity is, I'm always like, let's just figure it out.
So Aoife, I'm going to spare you the top that a question there.
I was going to say she's like Dr. Strange. Pardis, you're you're the real life Dr. Strange here. I'm like thinking in my head, yes. I'm not going to share any of my medical history with you, Pardis.
I'm going to stay with Pardis on that for just a second for a novelty moment, because Pardis, I noticed you referred to yourself a little bit like the Terminator. You said you're half metal now. You are in a band. you actually recorded a song called Flesh and Bone. We have a little bit of that here that I wanna play. Okay. So I don't know if we have it queued up. I think we thought we were gonna right close to the end, but I can't resist. I wanna do it now. Do we have that to play? So when I see that, Pardis, and then Aoife, we'll wrap with you. When I see that, I'm so glad we showed the video because you are reaching out. And you're talking about flesh and bone, but you're reaching out. And it looks like with every fiber of who you are. And in this work, is that what you do? Are you reaching out to the challenges? You talk a lot about collaboration, cross-country collaboration in your work. Is that what you do? Are you reaching out with every fiber of who you are to solve these problems?
Yeah, I think so. I think I wish it was a little bit more like that. I think I'm reaching out with some sort of a, that's a great question. I feel like I should think about that more and feel like I am doing that more. I'm not sure if that's what I'm doing, but I would strive to do it that way.
So Aoife, I'll turn to you now. The first time you and I met, we were having a conversation about immigration, in fact, and you were very passionate about the immigrant experience here in the U.S. and where we are in policy, et cetera. So I think the thing I want to ask you now is bridge the work you're doing, which you're focused on, you're curious about, you're resilient with, to the rest of the change that you want to see in the world. And how do you think about those connections? Or are they siloed is not always a good term. Are they different parts of your life?
You know, I think everything is so interconnected because when I think about the Massachusetts innovation ecosystem and how much, you know, just talking about some of the, you know, future threats, no one knows what the future is going to hold in terms of challenges. You know, there's, you know, all kinds of things coming down the pike at us that we just haven't invested for that we don't know. But one thing that can help us survive is science and diversity and resilience and all those kinds of things. And I think that's where it's all interconnected for me, you know, being open to different cultures, being open to opportunities. I mean, that's where true innovation happens and comes, is this exchange of ideas. And I just think we're going to need all of that, right? We're going to need all those brains and the best and brightest and put them in the right ecosystem where they can collide with each other and come up with really innovative solutions to some of the challenges that we don't even know are going to hit us, you know, down the road. So I think that's, for me, that kind of innovation piece is where the immigration, the diversity, the opportunity, the equality, all of that comes together in, you know, how do we foster and create a really inclusive innovation ecosystem? Because I just feel, you know, a mom of three kids, I don't know what challenges they're going to face in their lives, but I think it's going to be solved by science and it's going to be solved by innovation. And, you know, that's the piece that to me brings all of those threads together. So it's less compartmentalized and more just, you know, hub and spoke type of framework that centers on this kind of science-based innovation.
So let's stay there as we wrap and I'll ask you a listener question. What's next, do you think, Aoife, that will change our world?
Oh my goodness. So I work in synthetic biology and I, you know, if I was to spend a lot of time thinking about my concerns like soil failure, food insecurity, mass immigration, something that we haven't seen to date, all driven by climate change, you know, I wouldn't be able to sleep at night. But the thing that gives me hope is, you know, there's amazing technologies. I think biology is amazingly powerful. I think we have the tools, we have the innovation, we have the ability, it's just we need the will, right? We need the will to invest, we need the will to go there, to actually wake up and smell the coffee and, you know, see what's coming for us and start investing now in the technologies that are really going to help us feed, you know, a planet of, you know, 10 billion inhabitants with challenge of climate change and all of the upheaval that's going to occur. So I think, you know, I love SynBio because I think it has a huge potential to really help us address some of those issues. But, you know, and I try to focus on the positive because otherwise it's very difficult to function. I think if you get too much in the hole, but some of the scary stuff that could be coming down the pike.
How about you, Pardis? What's next that's going to change the world?
I mean, I think that it's too many things. I mean, it's the world is, I don't, there's a line that, there's a line I really like from Carl Sagan's book Contact, where there's an alien race that has kind of made it to Earth and is created a transporter that can take one person to meet them. And the main character, Ellie, is being asked by Congress to interview for the position and is asked, you know, if you could ask one question, only one question, what would it be? And she said, how did you do it? How did you survive your technological adolescence without destroying yourself? And I just thought that was such a powerful, that's like one of those lines from popular culture that's always stayed with me, because I think we're certainly in our technological adolescence, and the same tools that can transform the future can also destroy it. And it's not really clear where it's going to go. So, I mean, obviously I'm very, very excited about the power of biology and what it can do, but I'm also terrified of it and what it can do in the wrong hands. So to me, like a lot of the what is needed is really strong leadership, powerful leadership that's going to bring us to work together, I think, in the future. So much of like when I talk about outbreak response as an example of that, I just sort of say like the technology is there. We're not there. We're not ready for it. We're not equipped. We're not working together. And in a situation like that, the virus is certainly going to thrive. So I think from us, it's like it's working alongside the technology, but realizing how to like each other as human beings to get to the point where we do something really powerful and transformative in the right way.
I think our audience probably will take comfort that at least in our technological adolescence, some of that technology is in the two of yours good hands. I really appreciate your time. I'm going to wrap us here. Thank you, Aoife Pardies, for a fascinating hour. I learned a lot. I enjoyed a lot hearing from you. And I'll say to our audience, please join us for the next in our Phenomenal Women series on Wednesday, June 1st. If you join us then, I will be in conversation with tap dancer extraordinaire, choreographer, and MacArthur Fellow, Michelle Dorrance. But once again, Pardies Sabetti, Aoife Brennan, it's been a pleasure. You are phenomenal women. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Tiana.
Dr. Pardies Sabetti is the founder of Sabetti Lab, and Dr. Aoife Brennan is president and CEO of Synlogic Incorporated. And that's our show for today. Wishing you peace on this Memorial Day. Thanks for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering. Tune in tomorrow for more Radio Boston.